Sylvestre walked around himself, checking that nothing was seriously out of place. Satisfied, he cancelled the image and joined Girardio in the prefab's anteroom. The music reached a crescendo, then settled into a burbling refrain. The pattern of lights altered, voices dropping to a hush. Together they stepped into the glare, into the basso sound field of the organ's drone. A meandering path led to the central temple, carpeted for the occasion. Chime trees lined it, cased in protective domes of clear plastic. The chime trees were spindly articulated sculptures, their many arms tipped with curved, colored mirrors. At odd times, the trees would click and reconfigure themselves, moved by what seemed to be million-year-old clockwork buried in pedestals. Current thinking had it that the trees were elements of some citywide semaphore system. The organ's noise magnified as they stepped into the temple. Its egg-shaped dome was permeated by petal-shaped expanses of elaborate stained glass, miraculously intact despite the slow predations of time and gravity. Filtered through the top lights, the air in the temple seemed suffused with a calming pink radiance. The central portion of the enormous room was taken up by the rising foundation of the spire, which rose above the temple, wide and flared like the base of a sequoia. Temporary seating for 100 top-level Cuvier dignitaries bowed out in a fan shape from one side of the pillar, easily accommodated by the building, despite its one-quarter scale. Sylvestre scanned the racks of watchers, recognizing about a third of them. Perhaps a tenth had been his allies before the coup. Most of them wore heavy outer garments, plump with furs. He recognized Janaquin amongst them, sage-like with his smoke-white goatee and long silvery hair waterfalling from his bald pate. He looked more simian than ever. Some of his birds were in the hall, released from a dozen bamboo boxes. Sylvestre had to admit that they were now strikingly good facsimiles, even down to the bobbed crest and the speckled shimmer of their turquoise plumage. They had been adapted from chickens by careful manipulation of homeobox genes. The audience, many of whom had not seen the birds before today, applauded. Janaquin turned the color of bloodied snow and seemed anxious to sink into his brocade overcoat. Girardio and Sylvestre reached a sturdy table at the focus of the audience. The table was ancient, its woodwork eagle and Latinate inscriptions dated back to the Americano settlers on Yellowstone. Its corners were chipped. A varnished mahogany box sat on the table, sealed by delicate gold clasps. A woman of serious demeanor stood behind the table, dressed in an electric white gown. The gown's clasp was a complex dual sigil, combining the Resurgium City inundationist governmental seal with the emblem of the Mixmasters, two hands holding a cat's cradle of DNA. She was, Sylvestre knew, not a true Mixmaster. The Mixmasters were a cliquish guild of stoner bioengineers and geneticists, and none of their sanctum had journeyed to Resurgium. Yet their symbol, which had traveled, denoted general expertise in life sciences, gene sculpting, surgery, or medicine. Her unsmiling face was sallow in the stained light, hair collected in a bun, pierced by two syringes. The music quietened. "I am Ordinator Massinger," she said, voice ringing out across the chamber. "I am empowered by the Resurgium Expeditionary Council to marry individuals of this settlement, unless such union conflicts with the genetic fitness of the colony." The ordinator opened the mahogany box. Just below the lid lay a leather-bound object, the size of a Bible. She removed it and placed it on the table, then folded it open with a creak of leather. The exposed surfaces were matte gray, like wet slate, glistening with microscopic machinery. "Place one hand each on the page nearest you, gentlemen." They placed their palms on the surface. There was a fluorescent sweep as the book took their palm prints, followed by a brief tingle as biopsies were taken. When they were done, Massinger took the book and pressed her own hand against the surface. Massinger then asked Nils Girardio to state his identity to the gathered. Sylvestre watched faint smiles ghost the audience. There was something absurd about it, after all, though Girardio made no show of this himself. Then she asked the same of Sylvestre. "I am Daniel Calvin Laurien Soutin Sylvestre," he said, using the form of his name so rarely employed, that it almost took an effort of memory to bring it to mind. He went on, the only biological son of Rosalind Soutaine and Calvin Silvest, both of Chasm City, Yellowstone. I was born on the 17th of January, in the 121st standard year after the resettlement of Yellowstone. My calendrical age is 215. Allowing for medicine programs, I have a physiological age of 60, on the Sharavi scale. How do you knowingly manifest? I knowingly manifest in one incarnation only, the biological form now speaking. And you affirm that you are not wittingly manifested via alpha level or other Turing-capable simulacra in this or any other solar system, none of which I am aware. Massinger made small annotations in the book, using a pressure stylus. She had asked Girardio precisely the same questions, standard parts of the Stoner ceremony. Ever since the 80s, Stoners had been intensely suspicious of simulations in general, particularly those that purported to contain the essence or soul of an individual. One thing they especially disliked was the idea of one manifestation of an individual, biological or otherwise, making contracts to which the other manifestations were not bound, such as marriage. These details are in order, Massinger said. The bride may step forward. Pascal moved into the roseate light. She was accompanied by two women wearing ash-colored wimples, a squad of float cams and personal security wasps, and a semi-transparent entourage of entoptics, nymphs, seraphim, flying fish and hummingbirds, star-glittered dewdrops and butterflies, in slow cascade around her wedding dress. The most exclusive entoptic designers in Cuvier had created them. Girardio raised his thick, Hauser-like arms and bid his daughter forward. You look beautiful, he murmured. What Silvestre saw was beauty reduced to digital perfection. He knew that Girardio saw something incomparably softer and more human, like the difference between a swan and a hard glass sculpture of a swan. Place your hand on the book, the ordinator said. An imprint of moisture from Silvestre's hand was still visible, like a wider shoreline around Pascal's island of pale flesh. The ordinator asked her to verify her identity, in the same manner as she had asked Girardio and Silvestre. Pascal's task was simple enough. Not only had she been born on Resurgam, but she had never left the planet. Ordinator Massinger delved deeper into the mahogany box. While she did so, Silvestre's eyes worked the audience. He saw Janikin, looking paler than ever, fidgety. Deep within the box, polished to a bluish antiseptic luster, lay a device like a cross between an old-style pistol and a veterinarian's hypodermic. Behold the wedding gun, the ordinator said, holding the box aloft. Bone splinteringly cold as it was, Curry soon stopped noticing the temperature except as an abstract quality of the air. The story that her two crewmates was relating was far too strange for that. They were standing near the captain. His name, she now knew, was John Armstrong Brannigan. He was old, inconceivably so. Depending on the system one adopted in measuring his age, he was anywhere between 200 and 500 years old. The details of his birth were unclear now, hopelessly tangled in the countertruths of political history. Mars, some said, was the place where he had been born, yet it was equally possible that he had been born on Earth, Earth's city-jammed moon, or in any one of the several hundred habitats which drifted through cislunar space in those days. He was already over a century old before he ever left Sol system, Sir Jockey said. He waited until it was possible to do so, then was among the first 1,000 to leave, when the conjoiners launched the first ship from Phobos. At least someone called John Brannigan was on that ship, Volyova said. No, Sir Jockey said, there's no doubt. I know it was him. Afterwards, it became less easy to place him, of course. He may have deliberately blurred his own past, to avoid being tracked down by all the enemies he must have made in that time. There are many sightings in many different systems, decades apart, but nothing definite. How did he come to be your captain? He turned up centuries later, after several landfalls elsewhere, and dozens of unconfirmed apparitions, on the fringe of the Yellowstone system. He was aging slowly, due to the relativistic effects of starflight, but he was still getting older, and longevity techniques were not as well developed as in our time. Sajaki paused. Much of his body was now a prosthetic. They said that John Brannigan no longer needed a spacesuit when he left his ship, that he breathed vacuum, basked in intolerable heat and quenching cold, and that his sensory range encompassed every spectrum imaginable. They said that little remained of the brain with which he had been born, that his head was merely a dense loom of intermeshed cybernetics, a stew of tiny thinking machines and precious little organic material. And how much of that was true? Perhaps more of it than people wished to believe. There were certainly lies, that he had visited the jugglers on Spindrift years before they were generally discovered, that the aliens had wrought wondrous transformations on what remained of his mind, or that he had met and communicated with at least two sentient species so far unknown to the rest of humanity. He did meet the jugglers eventually, Valiova said in Kuri's direction. Triumvir Sajaki was with him at the time.
That was much later, Sajaki snapped. All that's germane here is his relationship with Calvin.
How did they cross paths?
No one really knows, Valiova said. All that we know for sure is that he became injured, either through an accident or some military operation that went wrong. His life wasn't in danger, but he needed urgent help, and to go to one of the official groups in the Yellowstone system would have been suicide. He'd made too many enemies to be able to place his life in the hands of any organization. What he needed were loosely scattered individuals in whom he could place personal trust. Evidently, Calvin was one of them.
Calvin was in touch with Ultra Elements?
Yes, though he would never have admitted so in public. Valiova smiled, a wide toothy crescent opening beneath the bib of her cap. Calvin was young and idealistic then. When this injured man was delivered to him, he saw it as a godsend. Until then he had had no means of exploring his more outlandish ideas. Now he had the perfect subject, the only requirement being total secrecy. Of course, they both gained from it. Calvin was able to try out his radical cybernetic theories on Brannigan, while Brannigan was made well and became something more than he had been before Calvin's work. You might describe it as the perfect symbiotic relationship.
You're saying the captain was a guinea pig for that bastard's monstrosities?
Sajaki shrugged, the movement puppet-like within his swaddling clothes.
That was not how Brannigan saw it.
As far as the rest of humanity was concerned, he was already a monster before the accident. What Calvin did was merely take the trend further. Consummate it, if you like.
Valiova nodded, although there was something in her expression which suggested she was not quite at ease with her crewmate.
And in any case, this was prior to the 80. Calvin's name was unsullied, and among the more overt extremes of ultra-life, Brannigan's transformation was only slightly in excess of the norm. She said it with tart distaste.
Carry on.
Nearly a century passed before his next encounter with the Sylvest clan, Sajaki said, by which time he was commanding this ship.
What happened?
He was injured again. Seriously, this time.
Gingerly, like someone testing himself against a candle flame, he whisked his fingers across the limiting extent of the captain's silvery growth. The captain's outskirts looked frothy, like the brine left on a rock pool by the retreating tide. Sajaki delicately swabbed his fingers against the front of his jacket. But Kuri could tell that they did not feel clean, that they itched and crawled with sub-epidermal malignance.
Unfortunately, Valiova said, Calvin was dead.
Of course. He had died during the 80, had in fact been one of the last to lose his corporeality.
All right, Kuri said, but he died in the process of having his brain scanned into a computer.
Couldn't you just steal the recording and persuade it to help you?
We would. Had that been possible?
Sajaki's low voice reverberated from the throated curve of the corridor. His recording, his alpha-level simulation, had vanished, and there were no duplicates. The alphas were copy-protected.
So basically, Cody said, hoping to shatter the morgue-like atmosphere of the proceedings, you were up Shit Creek without a captain.
Not quite, Volyova said. You see, all this took place during a rather interesting period in Yellowstone's history. Daniel Silvestre had just returned from the Shrouders, and was neither insane nor dead. His companion hadn't been so lucky, but her death only added additional poignancy to his heroic return. She halted, then asked with bird-like eagerness, "Did you ever hear of his 30 days in the wilderness, Curry?"
"Maybe once. Remind me."
"He vanished for a month, a century ago," Sir Jackie said. "One minute the toast of Stoner society, the next nowhere to be found. There were rumors that he'd gone out of the city dome, jammed on an exosuit, and gone to atone for the sins of his father. Shame it isn't true. Would have been quite touching."
"Actually," Sir Jackie nodded at the floor, "he came here for a month. We took him."
"You kidnapped Dan Silvestre?"
Curry almost laughed at the audaciousness of it all. Then she remembered they were talking about the man she was meant to kill. Her impulse to laugh evaporated quickly.
"Invited aboard is probably a preferable term," Sir Jackie said, "though I admit he didn't have a great deal of choice in the matter."
"Let me get this straight," Curry said. "You kidnapped Cal Sun. What good was that going to do you?"
"Calvin took a few precautions before he subjected himself to the scanner," Sir Jackie said. "The first was simple enough, although it had to be initiated decades before the culmination of the project. Simply put, he arranged to have every subsequent second of his life monitored by recording systems. Every second, waking, sleeping, whatever. Over the years, machines learned to emulate his behavior patterns. Given any situation, they could predict his responses with astonishing accuracy."
"Beta-level simulation?"
"Yes, but a beta-level sim orders of magnitude more complex than any previously created. By some definitions," Volyova said, "it was already conscious. Calvin had already transmigrated. Calvin may or may not have believed that, but he still kept on refining the sim. It could project an image of Calvin which was so real, so like the actual man, that you had the forceful sense that you were really in his presence. But Calvin took it a step further. There was another mode of insurance available to him."
"Which was?"
"Cloning." Sir Jackie smiled, nodded almost imperceptibly in Volyova's direction. "He cloned himself," she said, "using illegal black genetics techniques, calling in favors from some of his shadier clients. Some of them were ultra, you see. Otherwise we wouldn't know any of this. Cloning was embargoed technology on Yellowstone. Young colonies almost always outlaw it in the interests of ensuring maximum genetic diversity. But Calvin was cleverer than the authorities, and wealthier than those he was forced to bribe. That way he was able to pass off the clone as his son."
"Dan," Curry said, the monosyllabic word carving its own angular shape in the refrigerated air. "You're telling me Dan is Calvin's clone?"
"Not that Dan knows any of this," Volyova said. "He'd be the last person Calvin wanted to know. No, Silvestre is as much party to the lie as any of the populace ever were. He thinks he's his own man. He doesn't realize he's a clone. No, and as time goes by, his chances of ever finding out get smaller and smaller. Beyond Calvin's ultra-allies, almost no one knew, and Calvin set up incentives to keep those that did quiet. There were a few unavoidable weak links. Calvin had no choice but to recruit one of Yellowstone's top geneticists, and Silvestre picked the same man for the Resurgam expedition, not realizing the intimate connection they shared. But I doubt that he's learned the truth since, or even come close to guessing it. But every time he looks in a mirror, he sees himself, not Calvin." Volyova smiled, evidently enjoying the way their revelation was upsetting some of Curie's basic certainties. "He was a clone, but that didn't mean he had to resemble Cal down to the last skin pore. The geneticist, Janikin, knew how to induce cosmetic differences between Cal and Dan's makeup, enough so that people would see only the expected familial traits. Obviously, He also incorporated traits from the woman who was supposed to be Dan's mother, Rosalind Sutton.
The rest was simple, Sir Jackie said. Carla raised his clone in an environment carefully structured to emulate the surroundings he had known as a boy, even down to the same stimuli at certain periods in the boy's development, because Cal couldn't be sure which of his own personality traits were due to nature or nurture.
All right, Curry said, accepting for the moment that all of this is true. What was the point?
Cal must have known Dan wouldn't follow the same developmental path, no matter how closely he manipulated the boy's life. What about all those decisions that take place in the womb?
Curry shook her head.
It's insane. At the very best, all he'll end up with would be a crude approximation to himself.
I think, Sir Jackie said, that was all that Cal hoped for.
Cal cloned himself as a precaution. He knew the scanning process that he and the other members of the 80 would have to endure would destroy his material body. So he wanted a body to which he could return, if life in the machine turned out not to be to his liking.
And did it?
Maybe, but that was beside the point. At the time of the 80, the retransfer operation was still beyond the technology of the day. There was no real hurry. Cal could always have the clone put in reefer sleep until he needed it, or simply reclone another one from the boy's cells. He was thinking well ahead,
assuming the retransfer ever became possible. Well, Calvin knew it was a long shot. The important thing was that there was a second fallback option apart from retransfer,
which was
the beta level of simulation. Sir Jarkey's voice had become as slow, cold, and icy as the breezes in the captain's chamber. Although not formally capable of consciousness, it was still an incredibly detailed facsimile of Calvin. Its relative simplicity meant it would be easier to encode its rules into the wetware of Dan's mind. Much easier than imprinting something as volatile as the Alpha.
I know the primary recording. The Alpha disappeared, she said. There was no Calvin left to run the show, and I guess Dan began to act a little more independently than Calvin might have wished.
To put it mildly, Sir Jackie said, nodding, the 80 marked the beginning of the decline of the Sylvester Institute. Dan soon escaped its shackles, more interested in the Shrouder enigma than cybernetic immortality. He kept possession of the beta-level sim, though he never realized its exact significance. He thought of it more as an heirloom than anything else.
The Triumvir smiled. I think he would have destroyed it, had he realized what it represented, which was his own annihilation.
Understandable, Curry thought. The beta-level simulation was like a trapped demon, waiting to inhabit a new host body, not properly conscious, but still dangerously potent, by virtue of the subtle ingenuity with which it mimicked true intelligence.
Cal's precautionary measure was still useful to us, Sir Jackie said. There was enough of Cal's expertise encoded in the beta to mend the captain. All we had to do was persuade Dan to let Calvin temporarily inhabit his mind and body. Dan must have suspected something when it worked so easily.
It was never easy, Sir Jackie admonished.
Far from it. The periods when Cal took over were more akin to some kind of violent possession. Motor control was a problem. In order to suppress Dan's own personality, we had to give him a cocktail of neuroinhibitors, which meant that when Cal finally got through, the body he found himself in was already half paralyzed by our drugs. It was like a brilliant surgeon performing an operation by giving orders to a drunk, and by all accounts, it wasn't the most pleasant of experiences for Dan.
Quite painful, he said.
But it worked. Just. But that was a century ago, and now it's time for another visit to the doctor.
Your vials, said the ordinator. One of the wimpled aides from Pascal's party stepped forward, brandishing a vial identical in size and shape to the one which Sylvester removed from his pocket. They were not the same color. The fluid in Pascal's vial had been tinted red, against the yellow hue of Sylvester's. Similar darkish fronds of material orbited within. The ordinator took both vials and held them aloft for a few moments. before placing them side by side on the table, in clear view of the audience.
"We are ready to begin the marriage," she said.
She then performed the customary duty of asking if there were anyone present who had any bioethical reasons as to why the marriage should not take place. There was, of course, no objection. But in that odd, loaded moment of branching possibilities, Sylvestre noted a veiled woman in the audience reach into a purse and uncap a dainty, jeweled-topped amber perfume jar.
"Daniel Sylvestre," said the ordinator, "do you take this woman to be your wife, under resurgam law, until such time as this marriage is annulled under this or any prevailing legal system?"
"I do," Sylvestre said.
She repeated the question to Pascal.
"I do," Pascal said.
"Then let the bonding be done."
Ordinator Massinger took the wedding gun from the mahogany box and snapped it open. She loaded the reddish vial, the one Pascal's party had delivered, into the breech, then reclosed the instrument. Status Entoptics briefly haloed it. Girardio placed his hand on Sylvestre's upper arm, steadying him as the ordinator pressed the conic end of the instrument against his temple, just above his eye level. Sylvestre had been right when he told Girardio that the ceremony was not painful, but neither was it entirely pleasant. What it was a sudden flowering of intense cold, as if liquid helium were being blasted into his cortex. The discomfort was brief, however, and the thumb-sized bruise on his skin would not last more than a few days. The brain's immune system was weak by comparison with the body as a whole, and Pascal's cells, floating as they did in a stew of helper medicines, would soon bond with Sylvestre's own. The volume was tiny, no more than 0.1% of the brain's mass, but the transplanted cells carried the indelible impression of their last host, ghost threads of holographically distributed memory and personality. The ordinator removed the spent red vial and slotted the yellow one in its place. It was Pascal's first wedding under the stoner custom, and her trepidation was not well disguised. Girardio held her hands as the ordinator delivered the neural material, Pascal visibly flinching as it happened. Sylvestre had let Girardio think the implant was permanent, but this was never the case. The neural tissue was tagged with harmless radioisotope trace elements, enabling it to be rooted out and destroyed, if necessary, by divorce viruses. So far, Sylvestre had never taken that option, and imagined he never would, no matter how many marriages down the line he was. He carried the smoky essences of all his wives, as they carried him, as he would carry Pascal. Indeed, on the faintest level, Pascal herself now carried traces of his previous wives. That was the stoner way. The ordinator carefully replaced the wedding gun in its box.
"According to resurgam law," she began, "the marriage is now formalized. You may—"
Which was when the perfume hit Janikin's birds. The woman who had uncapped the amber jar was gone, her seat glaringly vacant. Fragrant autumnal, the odor from the jar made Sylvestre think of crushed leaves. He wanted to sneeze. Something was wrong. The room flashed turquoise blue, as if 100 pastel fans had just opened, peacocks' tails springing open, a million tinted eyes. The air turned grey.
"Get down!" Girardio screamed.
He was scrabbling madly at his neck. There was something hooked in it, something tiny and barbed. Numbly, Sylvestre looked at his tunic and saw half a dozen comma-shaped barbs clinging to it. They had not broken the fabric, but he dared not touch them.
"Assassination tools!" Girardio shouted.
He slumped under the table, dragging Sylvestre and his daughter with him. The auditorium was chaos now, a frenzied mass of agitated people trying to escape.
"Janakin's birds were primed,"
Girardio said, virtually screaming in Sylvestre's ear.
"Poison darts in their tails!"
"You're hit,"
Pascal said, too stunned for her voice to carry much emotion. Light and smoke burst over their heads. They heard screams. Out of the corner of his eye, Sylvestre saw the perfume woman holding a sleekly evil pistol in a two-handed grip. She was dousing the audience with it, its fanged barrels spitting cold pulses of Bozer energy. The float cam swept round her, dispassionately recording the carnage. Sylvester had never seen a weapon like the one the woman used. He knew it could not have been manufactured on Resurgam, which left only two possibilities. Either it had arrived from Yellowstone with the original settlement, or it had been sold by Remiliod, the trader who had passed through the system since the coup.
Glass, amaranthine glass that had survived 10,000 centuries, broke shrilly above. Like pieces of shattered toffee, it crashed down in jagged shards into the audience.
Sylvester watched, powerless, as the ruby planes buried themselves in flesh, like frozen lightning. The terrified were already screaming loud enough to drown out the cries of those in pain. What remained of Girardio's security team was mobilizing, but terribly slowly. Four of the militia were down, their faces punctured by the barbs. One had reached the seating, struggling with the woman who had the gun. Another was opening fire with his own sidearm, scything through Jennekin's birds. Girardio, meanwhile, was groaning. His eyes were rolling bloodshot, hands grasping at thin air.
"We have to get out of here," Sylvester said, shouting in Pascal's ear.
She seemed still dazed from the neural transfer, blearily oblivious to what was happening.
"But my father, he's gone."
Sylvester eased Girardio's dead weight onto the cold floor of the temple, careful to keep behind the safety of the table.
"The barb was meant to kill Pascal. There's nothing we can do for him. If we stay, we'll just end up following him."
Girardio croaked something. It might have been, "Go," or it might only have been a final, senseless exhalation.
"We can't leave him," Pascal said. "If we don't, his killers end up winning."
Tears slashed her face.
"Where can we go?"
He looked around frantically. Smoke from concussion shells was filling the chamber, probably from Girardio's own people. It was settling in lazy pastel spirals, like scarves tossed from a dancer. Just when it was almost too dark to see, the room plunged into total blackness. The lights beyond the temple had obviously been turned off or destroyed. Pascal gasped. His eyes slipped into infrared mode, almost without him having to think about it.
"I can still see," he whispered to her. "As long as we stay together, you don't have to worry about the darkness."
Praying that the danger from the birds was gone, Sylvester rose slowly to his feet. The temple glowed in gray-green heat. The perfume woman was dead, a fist-sized hot hole in her side. Her amber jar was smashed at her feet. He guessed it had been some kind of hormonal trigger, keyed to receptors Jennekin had put in the birds. He had to have been part of it. He looked, but Jennekin was dead. A tiny dagger sat in his chest, trailing hot rivulets down his brocade jacket. Sylvester grabbed Pascal and shoved her along the ground towards the exit, a vaulted archway gilded with amaranthine figurines and bas-relief graphic forms. It seemed that the perfume woman had been the only assassin actually present, if one discounted Jennekin. But now her friends were entering, garbed in camelioflage. They wore close-fitting breather masks and infrared goggles. He pushed Pascal behind a jumble of upturned tables.
"They're looking for us," he hissed, "but they probably think we're already dead."
Girardio's surviving security people had fallen back and taken up defensive positions, kneeling within the fan-shaped auditorium. It was no match. The newcomers carried much heavier weapons, heavy Bosa rifles. Girardio's militia countered with low-yield lasers and projectile weapons, but the enemy were cutting them apart with blithe, impersonal ease. At least half the audience were unconscious or dead. They had caught the brunt of the peacock venom salvo. Hardly the most surgically precise of assassination tools, those birds, but they had been allowed into the auditorium completely unchecked. Sylvester observed that two were still alive, despite what he had at first imagined. Still triggered by trace molecules of the perfume which remained aloft, their tails were flicking open and shut like the fans of nervous courtesans.
"Did your father carry a weapon?"
Sylvester said, instantly regretting his use of the past tense. "I mean, since the coup."
"I don't think so,"
Pascal said. Of course not. Girardio would never have confided such a thing to her. Quickly, Sylvester felt around the man's still body, hoping to find the padded hardness of a weapon beneath his ceremonial clothes.
"Nothing."
"We'll have to do without," Sylvester said, as if the stating of this fact would somehow alleviate the problem it encapsulated.
They're going to kill us if we don't run, he said finally. Into the labyrinth?
They'll see us, Sylvestre said.
But maybe they won't think it's us, Pascal said. They might not know you can see in the dark.
Though she was effectively blind, she managed to look him square in the face. Her mouth was open, an almost circular vacancy of expression or hope.
Let me say goodbye to my father first.
She found his body in the darkness, kissed him for the last time. Sylvestre looked to the exit. At that moment, the soldier guarding it was hit by a shot from what remained of Girardio's militia. The masked figure crumpled, his body heat pooling liquidly into the floor around his body, spreading smoky white maggots of thermal energy into the stonework. The way was clear, for the moment. Pascal found his hand, and together they began to run.